This program is provided by a trusted partner of the church and is educational, inspirational, and uplifting. It does not necessarily represent the official position of the church.
When it came to Scripture, he felt that the Lord revealed it to him and that it was his responsibility to make it available to the saints as soon as he possibly could.
Coming up next on the Joseph Smith Papers, the Book of Abraham.
The Mormon Channel presents the Joseph Smith Papers.
K-Jazz Television, in cooperation with the Church History Department of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, presents this weekly series highlighting the research of scholars and historians as they prepare for the publication of the Joseph Smith Papers. And now your host, Glenn Rawson.
In this series, we've discussed each of those books of Scripture that comprise the Latter-day Saint canon. That is, all except for one, the Book of Abraham. Since 1851, a part of the Pearl of Great Price. Our story begins in the late 18th century in the sands of Egypt.
Brian M. Hauglid.
You have to go all the way back to Napoleon with the Book of Abraham. In 1798, when 350 ships came into the Mediterranean there landed at Alexandria, Egypt, he had hundreds of artisans and scientists and people go out, and mappers and all sorts of people just taking notes and looking and discovering. And he was only there for 3 years. But our museums are still filled with many, many wonders of the ancient Egyptian world because of Napoleon and what he started there. That's where the Rosetta Stone was first found. During that time period, you have a person named Antonio Labolo. Very interesting person. He had been a soldier for Napoleon.
John L. Gee.
Not really an archaeologist, more of a gravedigger. The difference between an archaeologist and a gravedigger is an archaeologist publishes what he finds, and Labolo just dug it up and sold it on the open market.
Antonio Labolo was over several hundred, okay, not just a few, but several hundred workers that would dig into tombs and such down in Thebes in Upper Egypt. And at one of these tombs, we don't know exactly which one, but one of these tombs had a cache of mummies, hundreds of mummies.
Labolo stumbled across probably one of the most spectacular finds of Ptolemaic period Egyptian mummies that Egyptology has ever known. A lot of the collections in Europe owe their materials from this time period to Labolo's excavations, if we want to call it that.
We have some candidates for the tombs in Thebes. There's several of them, though. That's the problem. There is a popular one that some have felt is the one, but that one existed actually before Antonio Labolo, and so it's probably not.
Of the hundreds of mummies in the tomb, Labolo kept 11 of those as part of his personal collection.
They're in good shape. And there were papyri with these mummies that they had found with them in these tombs. And so Antonio Labolo kept those and had them brought to Italy, okay? And unfortunately, sometime after that, he gets very ill. The mummies themselves came from the period of about 150 B.C., and they were probably a royal family, maybe a priest, somebody like that, who was buried or mummified. They still did the mummification procedure, and then was buried with a text. And it was kind of a manual to get from, after you die, to get through the underworld into the presence of Osiris or the gods. And that text actually goes further back than that.
And Labolo, towards the end of his life, took his Egyptian collection and gave it to a shipping magnate named Albano Oblasser to sell to the highest bidder when they got to America, and then died about that time. Proceeds presumably would go to his family.
The mummies arrived in New York without Labolo, of course, and someone picked them up, we're not sure who, and began to travel with them and display them.
We think it was Michael Chandler, but further research has shown us that we're not able to really connect him quite yet. He went to Harrisburg, and he went to Boston, Massachusetts, and displayed these things. And along the way, he sold some of the mummies. By the time he gets to Boston, he's down to at least six mummies. Okay, and then by the time he gets to Kirtland in July of 1835, he's down to four mummies. He sold them along the way. And in fact, when he's in Kirtland, he puts another notice in the paper saying, "I want to sell these."
Chandler took the mummies and the other artifacts through many of the larger cities of the United States. His arrival in the small town of Kirtland, however, may have had another purpose besides just the displaying of the artifacts.
Of course, somewhere along the way, we don't know exactly where, he learns of a prophet named Joseph Smith who has the ability to translate ancient writings that people don't understand. And because the story goes that Michael Chandler asked about it because he had these writings, and so he would ask around and say, "Does anybody know how to read this stuff? You know, who would I go to find out if somebody could translate this material?" And along the way, Joseph Smith's name was mentioned. So he gets in town, he stays at the Riggs Hotel, and the owner of the hotel, Gideon Riggs, you know, he sends his son John over to the prophet and says, "You know, we have some interesting information here for you, some mummies and Egyptian things." And of course, that piques Joseph's interest. He gets those materials, especially the papyri, for 3 days. And he looks them over and he sends back and says, "Yes." Okay, and he tells a little bit about, you know, these are records of Joseph and Abraham or whatever, and kind of, you know, gets the point across that he's interested in these. And he wants to buy these papyri sheets. And Michael Chandler didn't want to sell them unless he would take those four mummies with him. And Joe said, "Well, I don't really have any use for mummies. I want the papyri."
This is a sample of Egyptian papyri, not, of course, from the Book of Abraham. Joseph decided to buy the Egyptian collection, mummies and all.
The mummies were bought for $2,400. And the money was raised by Joseph Coe and Joseph Smith and other members of the church. And they purchased these mummies for what then was a fair amount of money. And considering that museum admissions on the high end were about 25 cents, and that's what the mummies were being exhibited for, and that was just going rate. They've got at least five papyri, and in various stages of condition, some of them in better shape than others. And Joseph Smith got them and by revelation identified one of the records that he had as containing a Book of Abraham and one of the records as containing a Book of Joseph.
The mummies were sold to the church in July of 1835. Whereupon Joseph began working on the preparation of a text. Initially, it was a collaborative effort between him and his close associates, just trying to figure out what it was that they had.
Kay Dorowski.
We do know from his journal that in the fall of 1835, he was heavily involved with the mummies and translation. We have seven mentions in his journal. In October and November of working on translation. Things like, I labored on the Egyptian alphabet, I recommenced translating ancient records, I spent the day translating Egyptian records. Comments like that are in his journal. We also have 15 mentions in a three-month period of him showing the mummies to interested in visitors or explaining the Egyptian records. And so we know that this was an active part of his activities during that period of time. We are featuring a manuscript of this as a sample. We don't have dates. We just don't have good records to put with documents to say this was created on this date. And so we're featuring one as a sample of the work that was done, and we'll be dating that for around October 1835. We also have worksheets that Joseph, Oliver Cowdery, William W. Phelps, and Warren Parrish worked on, and this is a sample of one of those. They were just making an effort to take some of the hieroglyphics and hieratic writing, which is cursive Egyptian, and make English translations of them. We feel this was not involved with the translation of the Book of Abraham. These were just their attempts at understanding language. We also have a certificate from Michael Chandler. He was the exhibitor of the mummies that came to Kirtland, and he presented Joseph with a certificate that is dated 6 July 1835, stating that Joseph, he feels, has an understanding of Egyptian. And so those are the types of documents we have for Joseph Smith and the Book of Abraham. It'd be so nice if we had a beautiful manuscript with a date on it that said, Joseph gave this translation of the Book of Abraham. We just don't have that.
Many important matters affecting the church and Joseph Smith personally came at the same time that Joseph was working on these Egyptian documents.
Joseph S. Dorowski.
I think the Book of Abraham, to an extent, fits into a larger context. We tend to think of it in terms of the mummies turning up, the papyri, and then Joseph Smith beginning his translation. But at that point in time, he's already had a number of experiences working with ancient texts. And in a way, we almost have sort of a trajectory in Joseph Smith's life, going back to the Book of Mormon, coming forth of that, the time that he spent in translation of that, then the Book of Moses, received through Revelation, his work on the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible, and then we have the Book of Abraham. And so you can't think of the Book of Abraham as kind of occurring in some sort of abstract setting. It's occurring within a larger context. That's another aspect of it that's important to keep in mind. At least this initial period of involvement with the Book of Abraham happens at a time when there's an awful lot on his plate.
Because Joseph Smith never produced records that described in detail how he did the translation of these Egyptian documents, we just don't know for sure how he did it.
The question comes up, well, how did the translation process work? We have no records that tell us exactly how Joseph translated the Book of Abraham. We do have a statement from Warren Parrish, who was hired as a scribe by Joseph in October of 1835 and worked very closely with him during this time, where he says, I have sat by his side and penned down the translation of the Egyptian hieroglyphics as he claimed to receive it by direct inspiration of heaven. What's interesting about this is that Warren Parrish wrote this in a letter that was published in the Painesville Republican on the 5th of February, 1838, and it was after he left the church.
While it appears that Joseph tried to produce a publishable text while he was in Kirtland, it didn't happen. In early 1838, Joseph left Kirtland for northern Missouri. Shortly after, the manuscripts of the Book of Abraham, along with the associated artifacts, were delivered to Far West. Now, a contemporary journal account of the day those were delivered reveals some interesting details.
When the saints are driven out of Kirtland and move to Far West, Joseph Smith leaves earlier and Vincent Knight brings the mummies and the papyri and the records of the translation with him to Far West in 1838. And when they arrive, they um, Anson Call was there when they arrived and records in his journal that the mummies arrived and that they opened up the translation of the Book of Abraham and they read it out, and it took about 2 hours.
Kay Dorowski.
We do have this quotation from Anson Call's journal, which is used quite often to hint at the fact that there was more of the Book of Abraham than we have now. And I'll just read the whole entry. It says, late July 1838. While at Far West, I happened in the church store, and my attention was called by Vincent Knight, who was opening some boxes of goods. Says he, Joseph will be much pleased with these. He has been very uneasy about the translation of the Bible and the Egyptian records. Here they are, placing them upon the table. So we understand from this that the actual records, the manuscripts, are arriving in Far West at this point. From Kirtland. Says he to me, if you will take one of these, I will take the other, and we will carry them over to Joseph's office. There we found Joseph and 6 or 7 other brethren. Joseph was much pleased with the arrival of the books and said to us, sit down and we will read to you from the translations of the Book of Abraham.
The inspired text of the Book of Abraham was obviously important to the prophet Joseph Smith. Now, it's worth noting to us today that he may have had materials to work with that are just not available to us today.
Oliver Cowdery then read until he was tired, when Thomas Marsh read, making altogether about 2 hours. I was much interested in the work.
And this is very interesting because you read the Book of Abraham as we currently have it in the Pearl of Great Price out at a fairly slow, steady pace. It takes about half an hour to read aloud. And then it took about 2 hours.
The difficulties that the saints encountered in northern Missouri delayed Joseph, and he was not able to publish the text of the Book of Abraham. It's not surprising that with the mobbings, the drivings, and the relocation from Kirtland to Missouri and then from Missouri to Nauvoo, it took a toll on the papyri and also on the artifacts.
And then we have the outbreak of the Missouri War, Liberty Jail.
38 and 39
were pretty busy. Into 40, getting through that whole period. So it's really 40 and 41 before he might even have time, serious time. And perhaps he did look at that. There's evidence that in 38 he had hoped to get back to this because there's entries that talk about can we provide for the prophet to have time to spend with translation and so on and support him, provide the facilities and the means to be able to do that. But, of course, it doesn't work out because of the Missouri War erupting.
But by the time the records got to Nauvoo, they were in much worse shape than they were in Kirtland, at least the papyri were. And sometime around that time, they seem to have taken the outer ends of the papyrus roll that had come loose because of all the handling, because they're on the outside, and mounted them on paper and then stuck them under these in these picture frames. So they were framed and mounted. And they kept them that way, but there were still some rolls. And so eyewitnesses in Nauvoo who see the papyri, some of them describe them as in these glass-covered frames, and others of them describe seeing long rolls.
It had been nearly 7 years since Joseph first began his work on the Book of Abraham. By 1842 in Nauvoo, he was anxious about it.
At the end of 1841, beginning of 1842, Joseph Smith picks up the Book of Abraham again, starts revising the translation, and then he publishes that in early 1842. It's published in 3 installments in the Times and Season and ends with "to be continued" in the publication, but it never was. And, of course, we know that later in 1842, events such as organizing the Relief Society, which he does right after that, introducing the Temple Endowment, and then by summer he has people trying to kidnap him and take him over to Missouri, so he goes into hiding and is away for most of the last half of 1842, and then events just overtake him, and he never gets back to translating and publishing the Book of Abraham. So what we have is just the beginning.
We know very confidently that Joseph had translated not only a lot of the Book of Abraham, but that there was a lot more of the Book of Abraham.
With the prophet's death in June of 1844, his work on the Book of Abraham came to an end. Nothing further was done. That is until some church leaders in Great Britain decided to publish some of Joseph Smith's revelations in a new format, including the Book of Abraham.
This was gathered together from the newspaper reports and published in 1851 by Franklin D. Richards, who at the time was the youngest, the newest apostle, and had just been appointed as the mission president in England. Now, in the early 1850s, the bulk of church membership is actually located in England, and they have almost no church literature. So one of the things that they do is start up a church press, and they publish an English edition of the Book of Mormon, and they publish a number of tracts, and they also publish this collection that Richards puts together of early revelations of the prophet Joseph Smith that were published in church newspapers, and he calls it the Pearl of Great Price.
As the popularity of the Pearl of Great Price increased among the saints, it became apparent to church leaders that there was a need to make it more accessible.
And so the church commissioned, the 12 and the First Presidency commissioned Orson Pratt to look into the Franklin D. Richards Pearl of Great Price and go through it and see if he could make an American edition. And he kind of reformatted things. This is where you get the format that we have with the Book of Moses, starting at Moses 1 and going through to the way we have it today. And he produced that in 1878. And then in 1880, after John Taylor had, he'd been president of the 12 for 3 years after the death of Brigham Young in 1877. In 1880, they had a solemn assembly in October of 1880, wherein President Taylor was sustained as the new prophet of the church, and the Pearl of Great Price was added at that point into the canon of the church in 1880. And 10 years later, it was done again. Okay, where there apparently between 1880 and 1890, there was still a little bit of confusion as to, you know, well, are we sure? You know, and so the brethren did it again in conference and said, We accept this as one of the four standard works of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
The story of the Book of Abraham does not end with the publication of the Pearl of Great Price. Lucy Max Smith, Joseph's mother, inherited the Egyptian artifacts, and up until the day she died, she displayed them to visitors as a means of supporting herself.
Within 2 weeks of her death, the Emma Smith and her new husband, Louis Bideman, and Joseph Smith III sold the whole collection to a traveling salesman who happened to be passing through. And they go off on, and he goes down to St. Louis and gets rid of the bulk of the collection and sells it to the St. Louis Museum, which then sells it to the Wood Museum, which then moves from St. Louis to Chicago and is burned to the ground in 1871.
Church leaders and scholars have since discovered that the collection that Joseph Smith originally had was split up. Part of it came to be in Chicago, but the other part wound up in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
So in the 1960s, the Met is becoming really crowded with all kinds of material in the back rooms. And the people in charge at the Met say, well, we need to start thinning out the collections. There was a professor from the University of Utah who wrote to them and said, I'm going to be at these Egyptology meetings, and this is in the end of 1966, and they're on the East Coast, and I would like to swing up and do some research in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And they said, oh, that's fine. And when you come, we have something we want to show you. So they took him into one of the back rooms, and they showed him the papyri, and they said, do you think the Mormons, you live out in Utah, do you think the Mormons might want these? And so he said, well, I'll go see. And so he managed to get in touch with the church leaders, and they expressed interest, so they sent the, so they started with him as a go-between. His name is Aziz Atiyeh. It was November 27, 1967, when they were finally given to the church. And then Eldon Tanner came out and represented the church in New York. And they brought the papyri back to Salt Lake. The church, when they received the papyri, also received the bill of sale signed by Emma Smith for the papyri. That's one of the ways that they knew that these were the papyri that Joseph Smith had, is they had that bill of sale.
With the discovery of these mounted fragments, people, of course, expected to find the Book of Abraham on them, but it wasn't there.
They didn't realize the size of papyrus collection that Joseph Smith had. I think there were some naive expectations about what people would find there. But really, if you take time to carefully sift through the material and the historical material, we shouldn't expect to find any of the Book of Abraham on those papyrus fragments. Let me explain why. Eyewitnesses who saw the papyri in Nauvoo identify the Book of Abraham as being on a long roll. But that's at the same time when you have both long rolls and these mounted fragments. What we have is from the mounted fragments, and they identify the source as being on the long roll. So what we shouldn't expect that the fragments we have should be the Book of Abraham. And they're not.
There's much to be learned from the Book of Abraham, and while we do not have it all, what we do have is a pearl of great price indeed.
And what we do have is absolutely incredible in terms of the wonderful doctrines that it's restored, and the plain and precious truths. That's what I like to refer to them as, the plain and precious truths. I mean, we learn so much more about, and we have more on foreordination, we have more on priesthood. Priesthood is not even mentioned once. The word priesthood is not even mentioned once in the life of Abraham in the Bible, in the Genesis account. It's mentioned over and over again.
Next week on the Joseph Smith Papers, significant doctrinal developments in the city of Nauvoo, such as work for the dead. I'm Glenn Rossin. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Joseph Smith Papers here on the Mormon Channel.